so I'm here with Ellen Ruppelshell, who is most recently the author of Cheap. Ellen, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Ed.
First off, I want to start off by the obvious question. First of all, what accounts for this phenomenon of discount culture? You point to this idea of someone who is willing to drive 75 miles out of their way to an outlet store to buy inferior goods for a cheap price, or even in your case, the car that's in your driveway. I'm wondering if you feel that it's the hunting aspect of bargain hunting. Should we blame Edward Bernays for this? What's the deal here? Let's start.
Well, you know, the instinct for bargains is as old as humankind, right? I mean, the bazaar, the ancient bazaars were a place of haggling, and all of us have an instinct toward what we consider fairness. And fairness generally, for most of us, is what works for us. So discounting, or the idea of getting a good deal, is part of game playing and winning. And psychologists, there's a great literature on this about why we are so intrigued and compelled to act by bargains.
Yeah.
Marketers have gotten very, very good at triggering this instinct. And again, we do vary as to how bargain-prone we are. Not everyone is equally bargain-prone, but enough of us are that it is definitely more than a trend. Most of what we buy in terms of consumer goods in the United States, we buy at a discount.
Yeah. So would you say that it's along the lines, I suppose, of the ultimatum game or game theory, which you bring up in the course of the book? Do you think that perhaps game theory does not account for the fact, like in such a scenario, if I give more than 50% of my share to somebody else, then actually I've been given this from somebody else, and everybody stands to win, and I still get something out of it. Getting game theory into the particular equation? I mean, is it possible that we're being too theoretical about this human impulse, or?
Well, I think that it simply explains a behavior that is, to some degrees, irrational. So let's take the ultimatum game, which is, just sort of a model that economists use to explain this kind of strange behavior, and psychologists use it. So to just get into it a bit, if I give there are two players in the game, and if I give one $10 and tell that player, look, you need to divide this with the other player, and the other player can take or leave the division. If the other player leaves the division, neither player gets any money. And if he takes it, they both get it as divided. So if the first player offers 50% cut, obviously the second player is likely to take it. But if the first player offers the other player, say, $3 and keeps $7, the second player is much less likely to take the deal, which means both players lose. Neither player gets any money. So this seems irrational because $3 is more than no dollars. Why wouldn't you want to take that? And that is because for most of us, the predilection toward fairness or getting a good deal or getting a better deal than others get is very, very strong. We want to get the best possible deal. And what we often forget is that if there is a discount, it means that someone somewhere, at least theoretically, should be paying a higher price, the so-called full price.
Yeah.
But the fact is that very few of us actually pay full price, quote-unquote full price, for goods, consumer goods anymore. We're buying much of what, if not most of what we buy, at discount. And what does that mean? It means that all of us are getting a discount, okay? And that means that the object itself is really worth, at best, the discounted price.
Yeah. You bring up Gresham's Law a few times in the book, that principle in which bad money drives out the good. Your example involves watered-down milk over purer milk. But as you're pointing out, both in the book, with the idea of Americans having less spending money for T-shirts and lettuce, and in this particular idea that you just said in your last answer about looking for the ultimate bargain, if we have indeed become accustomed to our watered-down milk, why then would we possibly start accustoming ourselves to purer milk or this higher aspect of craftsmanship? If there is no economic incentive for us to do so, then surely are we trapped in this cycle of bad money driving out the good?
Well, that's a really good question. And Gresham's Law is concept, I think, for us to keep in mind. Grisham's Law, the so-called bad money driving out good, was illustrated, as you mentioned, with this milk example. And that is, if there are merchants who are selling, or retailers selling, watered-down milk at 80 cents a gallon, and this is just theory. We know we don't pay 80 cents a gallon anymore for milk. But if they're selling watered milk for 80 cents a gallon and full milk for $1.20 a gallon, and they write that on the label, look, this is watered-down milk, this is full milk, people who want a bargain or want to pay less buy the watered-down milk, and there's no problem there. They know what they're getting. But if it becomes the case that watered-down milk gets sold as milk, just milk, okay, both kinds are sold as milk, and we're charged 90 cents, it seems that we're getting a bargain when we buy this watered milk, because we just assume it's milk, okay? Yeah. And those who try and sell full milk at $1.20 a gallon will go out of business, because this low price, we're driven by price, not quality, right? We're looking at the price, then they will go out of business. So pretty soon everyone is selling watered-down milk at 90 cents, and we all think we're getting a bargain. And this is a metaphor I use for American retail culture today. Many of us are buying what I consider to be, including myself in this, watered down milk, and paying a low price for it, and thinking we're getting a bargain.
Yeah.
We're not getting a bargain. We're getting watered down milk at a somewhat higher price than we might be paying if all the actors were transparent, if we really knew what we were getting. And another thing I say in the book is that knowledge in the marketplace is probably the most valuable thing, actually knowing what you're getting. But in global retail culture, it's very, very difficult to know what you're getting.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. The Internet hasn't helped us all that much. There's all sorts of tricks that retailers use to hide the provenance, the background, and the manufacturing techniques that go into building their products. It's very, very difficult to know. And I go into all the different tricks in the book, and I won't bore you today with all the tricks. But so many of us go into retail stores not knowing what we're getting. So what we are is price-driven, since it's the only thing we can, the only so-called objective factor is price, and that's how we make our comparisons. And one of the things I point out in the book is, in fact, price is not objective. It's probably one of the most subjective factors in purchasing. But we think it's objective, and so we use it as a marker.
Well, there's also the innovation of the price tag and the fact that you no longer have a scenario in which the buyer can, in fact, haggle with the seller. That relationship has completely changed in the last 120 years. And I'm wondering if you feel that if we were to restore that particular impulse, we might perhaps drive out this additional impulse, this present impulse. I mean, you know, we go to Kayak to get the best flight deal. We go to Google Shopping to find out who's selling that iPhone or the iPod or whatnot at the lowest possible price. And yet, at the same time, price is elastic. As you point out in the book, the common example used is when the iPhone initially came out, it was marked $200 more than when it was 2 months later. And a lot of people were upset by this. So if the buyer has no control over the price, then I'm wondering if offering some kind of return to haggling in some sense might be a part of the solution here, or is our relationship with, for example, third world labor so interdependent upon cheap labor and cheap goods that it's impossible now?
I think haggling over price has become quite difficult for the very reasons I cited before. We have real difficulty knowing what things are worth. And you talk about the price tag, that's true. The price tag is a more recent innovation than I think people realize. It was invented in the 1800s in the 1900s by, let me check the date on that. But in any case, it's about a 120-year-old invention, as you say, invented by a retailer named Wanamaker, who had was actually the first among the first people to devise the notion of sales. He was actually a really good guy. He believed that his idea was that his own employees should be able to afford the things that he had, and he devised the whole sale model, a low-cost model. He kind of popularized that model And after that, the model was kind of perverted by a colleague of his, by Frank Walworth, who many of us have probably heard about and read about historically, who believed that the way to keep prices low was to pay his clerks as little as possible and to de-skill the position of clerk. That means that they had very little knowledge, very little authority, and he would pay them $2 to $3 a week, which forced them to live at home with their parents and allowed them very little latitude. So the Woolworth model is a more typical model in some of the discount empires today, the most famous being Walmart, in which people are paid, employees are paid quite poorly on average, and there's a very, very high turnover. So that's the model. The Walmart model was actually a very old model that was started by Frank Woolworth. But to respond to your question about whether I think fixed prices, unfixing the prices, freeing the prices, allowing us to haggle over price would be helpful, that's probably, it's an interesting idea, and I could imagine it happening. I think certainly when we buy a used car, for example, we apply that method still. There are still things we do haggle over. When we go to a flea market, we can haggle. But in general, I don't think we're going to lose the price tag. I don't think we're going to go back. What I'm suggesting that consumers do is think a lot about the object and less about the price.
Yeah.
And put the object first and the price second.
Yeah, it's more of the illusory idea also of haggling in a scenario in which we are talking about goods that are shipped from somewhere else or services that are expensive. For example, Priceline has essentially marketed themselves with the idea that you set your own price, but you don't in fact set your own price because these prices are already fixed in some level. I mean, how do you get beyond human psychology so that people understand that they really don't have much power in their pricing, in these pricing decisions?
Right, we don't. And I think once we let go of the feeling that we're actually getting a good deal when we buy things and actually look at what we're buying and deciding whether or not we want this thing and whether or not it's worth the money that they're asking for it to us, to look at the thing first. So, for example, an example I use in the book is the mattress, okay? Mattress, virtually no one pays full price for a mattress. Mattresses are typically on sale in department stores, for example. Okay, and the way it works is this. A department store might have four different mattress brands, and what they tend to do is rotate those brands and put one on sale every month or every 2 months, and they typically assume that the consumer is only going to buy the mattress that's quote-unquote on sale. And the reason they do this is because the other mattresses are higher priced and they become the reference price for that mattress. We look at those other prices and that's what we think, oh, that's the price of a mattress. This one's on sale. I'm buying this one. But in fact, the real price of the mattress is the discounted price. That's the real price of that mattress, okay? That's the price in which the department store will make a legitimate profit, and they expect only to sell those mattresses, by and large, those mattresses. And that's because we don't really know, most of us don't know much about mattresses. We don't really know what a mattress is worth. So we go into the store, all we can do is look at the price and look at the reference prices, the higher prices of the mattresses not on sale, and we say, hey, this is a good deal. I'm taking this mattress. And this is something that is perfectly legal as long as they have the mattress at full price at least some of the time. Even though they don't sell it at that full price, they're able to call the other price a discount price. So what I'm trying to enlist consumers to consider, and obviously the book has a lot on the politics and the economics of this, and I went to China, I went, to Europe, I did a lot of, sort of more theoretical research and writing in the book, but in terms of news that consumers can use, I'm trying to get them to think much more proactively about their purchases and so that they will be happier with their purchases. Okay, many of us are actually not all that happy with many of our discount purchases. And in fact, there have been experiments to show that if you discount pain medication, it's actually less effective in terms of controlling pain in humans. If you discount the cost of it, it's less effective. We believe in it less. And when we buy discounted, deeply discounted products, often we discount their usefulness. We devalue them to some degree. So I'm trying to get readers to think and consumers to think about what they truly value and to become not cheap but frugal or thrifty. That's the, as you know, if you've read the entire book, that's, you know, the final chapter I talk about the new frugality and people sort of thinking about, hey, what's going to work for me? What's really going to work for me? What's going to last, at least as long as I need it to last? And what is, what do I really want?
Yeah.
What do I really want?
Well, it's not just the consumer. I mean, you quote Jason Furman, who is an economic advisor to Obama, as saying that Walmart's price reductions have actually benefited the workers to the tune of $263 billion in 2004. And when you spoke with him, you write that he had actually underestimated this benefit. But as you're pointing out in the book and in this answer, again, this quality of goods varies from store to store. What's at Walmart and what's at Whole Foods, etc., is going to be different. Are you suggesting then that Furman is placing an absolute price tag on these economic benefits without accounting for this relativism in quality? Or was he cognizant of that relativism when you actually talked with him? I'm curious.
Actually, it was Jerry Hausman who I spoke with at MIT, and you're right in that Furman based his op-ed in the Times on the work of Jerry Hausman, who's an economist, a very accomplished economist at MIT. A lot of writing on the Walmart effect and the benefits of Walmart are based on the work of this MIT economist, Jerry Hausman, who, as I said, is quite an eminent economist. However, I did interview Dr. Hausman at length, and when we really got down to it, he is a theoretical economist. This is something he's kind of doing on the side, almost as, I don't want to say it's for fun, but it's not his normal economic research is quite theoretical and mathematical, and this is almost a diversion for him. And so what he did, what Dr. Hausman did, was he surveyed a number of products sold at Walmart and found, in fact, that in the category of food, it did seem to offer lower prices and save people a good deal of money. But in fact, when you look carefully at that market basket, and when I interviewed Hausman, it was really kind of funny because he hadn't thought of this. When you look carefully at that market basket of what he was reviewing, these were all staples, sort of generic goods like hamburger, paper products, lettuce, things that were generic in which the quality was not controlled for. So I asked him, look, how do we know that the chicken parts that you're looking at Walmart are of the same quality or the equivalent of nearby stores? And he said, I hadn't really accounted for the quality factor. So when you look back closely, when you go back actually look at overall products at Walmart, the actual savings is quite small. And in one-third of products, you actually pay more at Walmart, or I think it's one-third products you pay more at Walmart, or certainly no less at Walmart. And the average savings at Walmart is actually quite low. So the discounters sell only what they can buy cheaply and in great bulk. So not everything at Walmart is discounted. You mentioned the Apple iPhone. We all know that when Walmart started selling the Apple iPhone, which was not until the final week of 2008, it only knocked off $2 from the full price. Not a huge savings on a device that is, several hundred dollars to buy. So, in fact, Walmart's, we don't generally know the prices. When we go into a Walmart or in any discount store, we only, on average, know the prices of 1% to 2% of the goods in that store. And those are the things that are most likely to be discounted, the things that we buy a lot of, like hamburger and lettuce, the kinds of things that Hausman was looking at. But we don't necessarily know the prices, and we tend not to know the prices, of over 90% of things in that store. So whether or not those things are discounted, we really won't know. Yeah. And generally speaking, as I said, the prices at Walmart, the average savings at Walmart is only 37 cents per item, okay? And as I said also in the book, only a third of items about one-third of items carry savings of no more than 2 cents, okay? So the savings at Walmart, on average, is not as great as many people think, And what Walmart uses, as do many discount stores, is the time-honored system of the so-called loss leader. So the example I use in the book is, you know, they might put hot dogs on sale and hot dog buns and ketchup and paper towels, and they'll put all that in the front of the store, and it'll look like, wow, you know, these hot dogs are cheaper than I can find them anywhere else, and so are the paper towels, and here it is summer, I'm going to do a barbecue, and this is a great deal. And once they've got you in the store, you don't notice that the prices on things that you don't think about the prices of. For example, I don't know how much I spend on dishwashing liquid, okay? Do you know how much you spend on do you use dishwashing liquid?
Yeah, I spent $3 for one for the bottle this week. So I keep I try to pay attention to that thing. I'm a freelancer. What can you say?
It was exactly $3.
I'm rounding up. So therefore, I could hypothetically be exploited by the definitions of your own particular term, or if they were actually going ahead and doing the whole $2.99 thing, where I may actually psychologically believe it to be in the $2 range when in fact it's in the $3 range. So yeah, it's a good point.
There you go. I have no idea, you know, if my dishwashing liquid was $2.97 or $3.01 or what. Like you, I would say, yeah, it's about $3. Well, you know, it might be $2.97 at Walmart and $3.05 at a full price store, or it could be vice versa, and you wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
Okay? The kinds of things you buy all the time, are the kinds of, like, milk. Okay, that's a classic. If you have a family, and I don't know if you do, but if you have a family, especially a large family, you tend to know the cost of milk, okay? If you drive a car, you tend to carefully monitor the cost of gasoline. So you play that game with yourself. But most things that you buy, mattresses are a great example because we buy them so rarely, we really don't know the price of. So it's easy to manipulate public perception of price, very, very easy.
Or it's easy to manipulate public opinion because we are talking only about a few pennies here, essentially. I mean, from one store to another. And as such, our failure to understand what the actual price difference is, done times millions, equals millions more in profit. So this actually is a good issue that you brought up, because I wanted to bring it up in relation to Whole Foods, which you bring up in the book. I mean, you point out, of course, that the economic shakeup caused the demand for organic food last year to decline considerably. And this brings me to ask you about consumer cognizance. I'm wondering if what we're talking about here can be blamed entirely on the idea of looking for the cheapest price, or whether... one thing you don't bring up in the book is Veblen's idea of conspicuous consumption. Are we driven to a luxury good like Whole Foods because it's affordable, or because we want to pay more for it? I mean, it's a very interesting chicken and egg argument.
Right. Well, you know, the reason I bring up Whole Foods, what I discuss in the book, is this whole notion of high versus low, what I call a false dichotomy. If you want quality, we think, okay, as consumers, if you want quality, you have to pay a premium for it. And I argue against that. And I use Whole Foods because Whole Foods, many of us think of as kind of a cool, crunchy granola company, when in fact, Whole Foods was vehemently anti-union, for example, doesn't always use local farm products. It drives very hard deals with its suppliers, and charged very high prices. So it was a high price especially for a supermarket chain, a small one. It was a very, very high margin business. And we got the idea, and I have a quote there from a marketer who said that Whole Foods perpetrated the idea that if you wanted quality, you had to pay, and you had to pay a lot. And I use that as an unfortunate example. I don't believe that you should have to pay a lot for quality. And that's why I bring in the other supermarket chain, which is Wegmans, which is a supermarket chain that is a much more moderately priced outfit, that they work assiduously to keep prices fair and at the same time treat their employees extremely well. Okay, and I, you know, use that as a counterexample, and one that I think is very scalable, as opposed to the Whole Foods model. And as we know now, I mean, Whole Foods is losing traction in this market, and it has started to reduce the prices, especially, again, of its high-volume products, you know, things like skinless, boneless chicken breasts and things like that that we buy a lot of. They've worked, again, and ground meat is another one, in which Whole Foods has tried to reduce the prices to try and keep up with this recessionary climate. But what I talk about in the book is this false dichotomy, the notion that just to get quality of any kind, we have to pay a premium. We either have Walmart and discounted goods, radically discounted goods, we have to pay a high price. And I argue against that, because what I'm calling for is return of the middle ground, okay? The midway, the way where you can buy, you can purchase things with a reasonable amount of service, knowing what you're getting, perhaps knowing the proprietor of the place that you're going to, maybe not, but certainly knowing that you've got something that is worth buying and paying a reasonable price, maybe not the very lowest price. And as I point out, you know, Wegmans does not try to undercut prices of its neighbors. It tries to focus both on the quality of the goods and to keep the price reasonable and affordable for middle-class Americans. The other thing I point out is when we go to discount stores, we actually tend to overbuy. So we spend, in a discount mall, an outlet mall, we tend to spend 80% more, which is astonishing. I had no idea until I did this book that we actually spend 80% more when we go to an outlet mall than when we shop in a regional mall. Now, I've been to outlet malls, and I go crazy. And mm-hmm. Typically, we tend to do that. And again, this book help me understand my own irrational behavior, because when I walk into an outlet mall, I assume that everything's a good deal, and I tend to loosen my resolve. I, you know, throw things in my cart that I normally wouldn't throw in my cart. And in fact, the very use of a shopping cart when we're shopping in these places is bizarre. I mean, many of us are old enough to remember when department stores did not have shopping carts.
Yeah.
Shopping carts are a great innovation for retailers, because we tend, on average, when we use a shopping cart, to buy at least one more thing per shopping trip.
Yeah.
Because it frees us up to throw whatever we want into it. So some little thing that costs $3 or $4, you don't even think about it. You throw it in there, and you come out, and one person I was talking to recently said, you know, why is it every time I walk into Target, I never spend less than $100?
Yeah.
I never do. When everything's so cheap. And I put it back to him, and I said, well, that because everything is so cheap, you spend $100. You're not thinking about any particular purchase. And you don't think of the overall purchase price, which is over $100. You think, hey, this towel is $7. That's a great deal. This T-shirt is, you know, $7. It's a great deal. You throw this stuff in your cart. You don't really think about the stuff you're buying, and you walk out, you know, paying $110 when you went in thinking you were going to get a great bargain.
But it's also not just the price that is set by the store. I mean, you point to one extraordinary shift in recent years. I don't think I'm going to be eating shrimp in a long time because of your example, but shrimp went from a delicacy to something that is now cheap and ubiquitous. I mean, aquaculturists figured out how to harvest get them passed through the post-larvae stage in Thailand, and the World Bank then went ahead and forced millions of dollars into the shrimp industry, and the customer is now going to a Red Lobster, and using the example that you cite from a Red Lobster blog, sitting down and in one sitting eating as much as 200 shrimp. So, you know, at the end of the book, you say that, you know, okay, the free market is essential. But what about this hypothetical Red Lobster diner who wants to eat 200 shrimp for the lowest possible price? He's going to tell you that his needs are essential too.
Absolutely, and mazel tov. I mean, good luck. I feel sorry for him the next morning. you know, I can't. That was a great one. I was looking for, you know, what I went on these waiters blogs. These are very funny. I encourage anyone to have a look and to hear about, you know, the worst customer experiences these waiters have encountered, and waitresses, wait people. And one was from a Red Lobster waiter who, as you describe that, he He talks about a patron who ordered 20 servings of shrimp, 10 to a serving, which came to 200 shrimp. And I hope he tipped well, because this little exercise in gluttony is definitely stomach-turning. But the reason he was able, obviously, it's quite unlikely that Red Lobster made a profit on that particular patron. But they do make a good profit on the patrons who are gorging themselves on two or three servings of this all-you-can-eat shrimp. And the reason is because shrimp, as you pointed out, when I was a young person many, many years ago, shrimp was something of a luxury, and it's something that you ate for special occasions, and you kind of appreciated what you were eating, because it was something that was pulled from the ocean, and it was very difficult to domesticate shrimp for all sorts of reasons, and so it was a bit of a luxury. As I point out in the book, aquaculture allowed us to figure out ways to raise shrimp in confinement, and the most typically it's done in the developing world. For the example I use is in Thailand, where the mangrove swamps, which were essential to the ecology of the Thai coastline, were basically ripped up to make room for these shrimp ponds. And these shrimp ponds are muddy-bottomed, crowded, microbe-infested, because they're so crowded, ponds, and they're doused with antibiotics to keep the shrimp from dying. And as many of us have experienced, these shrimp, what we think of now as shrimp, and I live in New England, and most of the shrimp I get, even though I live in a seafaring area, comes from Thailand, imported from Thailand. You can get fresh Maine shrimp, but it's much more of a rarity than this Thai shrimp or Indonesian shrimp that is grown in these ponds. And, you know, it's really not shrimp the way we think of shrimp. It is agriculturally manufactured shrimp that doesn't have the taste of Gulf shrimp, the kind of shrimp that, you know, I had as a kid, maybe you had as a kid. And I've switched back to the Gulf shrimp, which costs not that much more. When you consider the amount of effort that goes into, harvesting Gulf shrimp, the diesel fuel, the fishing expertise, actually the cost of Gulf shrimp is not that much more than the cost of the shrimp farmed off the coast of Thailand, which has been devastating, by the way, to the Thai ecology, just very bad. And I detail, just how bad in the book, and also has contributed to severe labor abuses and other problems in Thailand. And you know, it was funded maybe with funded by the World Bank. For whatever reason, it hasn't worked out so well for many people in that country, and especially many of the migrant workers in that country. But it has caused the price of shrimp in this country to plummet and made it actually more difficult for American fishermen to compete. So ultimately it comes down to taste and the product itself. And what I encourage consumers to do is to think about, gee, do I want 200 red lobster shrimp, for $15? I mean, is that really my priority? Well, maybe for some of us it is. And as I said, muzzle tough, good luck to you. But for many of us, we want a choice of something that really tastes great, really tastes like the sea, tastes like what, we used to think of as shrimp tasting like, and we're willing to spend just a little bit more, $1 or $2 a pound for the real deal, But if we're driven only by price, we won't even look at the provenance of that shrimp. And before I did this book, I never did either.
Yeah.
I never did. It never even occurred to me. I had noticed that shrimp didn't taste so good. It didn't taste like what I imagined shrimp should taste like. It's kind of mushy and kind of muddy tasting, but I hadn't really thought about why until I did the book. And then I've made the switch, and gosh, it's a lot better.
Yeah.
It really is.
But simultaneously, if the shrimp harvesting industry is out of sight, out of mind, just as IKEA's practices, which do involve, in a few cases, illegal wood cutting for all of that particular furniture and the like, that they, as you point out, they only have five or six people in the entire world supervising the legality of all of this clear-cutting, which is fantastic because there's no possible way that you could supervise at all. So if it's all out of sight and out of mind, and we are determined to live a lifestyle as all the money invested in the IKEA catalog demonstrates, how then can we possibly become aware, even on this small level of saying purchasing one type of shrimp over another? I mean, you observe repeatedly in this book also, and I'm sorry to throw a bunch of things at me, but I think they all tie in, that Chinese workers in the American middle class have more in common than they realize. But again, when Wang Chung Chu talked to you, he said the Chinese workers don't have the luxury to concern themselves with human rights. I mean, if we all have ourselves to blame here, at what point do we actually pay attention to the interconnectedness of all this? And at what point do we essentially, say, for example, the Chinese laborers, when do they revolt? When do they say enough is enough? I mean, you know, we can continue to go around the world and find the cheapest possible labor, the cheapest possible products. And there's got to be a limit at some point.
Well, you know, this race to the bottom, we all know about the race to the bottom, and what I point out in the book is there's this argument, well, look, you know, for example, people in the developing world or China, which, you know, it's really questionable whether that's a developing world anymore. I mean, it's an incredibly sophisticated society. And we raise the question of, well, you know, don't these people, isn't this a job? Isn't this what they want? I mean, come on, we're pulling them out of the countryside where they're starving, we're giving them jobs. They're better off, aren't they, working in the factories in Eastern China, Western China, than they are back in their provinces, starving to death on their farms. And I make an argument in the book, which is some kind of, you know, it's a little complicated to say quickly, of why that's a kind of a simplistic argument. In fact, you know, the Chinese, just like all of us, would like better working conditions, better wages. There's no question there. And what I discovered when I went to China was that the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, this is American multinationals like Nike and Intel and Microsoft, were actually lobbying against union protections of Chinese workers. So the Chinese themselves, many, 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 would prefer to have these protections. But the American interests, the multinational interests, are repressing them and preventing them, helping to prevent them from getting the kinds of things that they want. And in fact, in 2007, there was into 2008, there was an immigration of Chinese workers from the cities back to the countryside. They were starting to rebel. There were hundreds and hundreds, thousands actually, of protests in China, and those protests, many of them were repressed. By a government, again, very, very interested in productivity and in capitalism and in getting things off the ground in China. But it had nothing to do with what the Chinese wanted themselves. So I want to dispense immediately with the idea that people are better off, you know, workers in the developing world and also in China, are better off in sweatshop conditions than they are back in the countryside, because I found much evidence to the contrary of that. So let's start there. But then you ask the question, well, you know, how are people going to know this and what steps, you know, will they take? And I say, well, look, as I said when we started, knowledge in the marketplace is very scarce and hard to come by. And so part of the book, you know, part of my reason for writing this book was to get knowledge out there and get people to understand the consequences of their purchases. And you mentioned wisely that the American middle class and the Chinese peasantry or working class have a lot more in common than they think. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the average income for Americans, as we all know, has declined in the last 10 years as profits and productivity have soared. At the same time, we spend less and less for consumer goods. We spend more and more for things we can't live without, like health care, like our mortgages, okay? Like taxes, health insurance, okay? The fixed expenses that we cannot live without. We spend three-quarters of our income on those fixed expenses, where in the 1970s, we only spent half our income on those fixed expenses.
Yeah.
So we have, even though we're making more, we have two, you know, now we have families where both partners are working. Theoretically, we should be making more money and getting traction, but we're not. We're not, because those fixed costs, those inelastic costs, are skyrocketing. health insurance, education, you know, medicine, you know, child care, which was not even a major factor in the 1970s. All these things have skyrocketed in cost, and the way we keep prices low on consumer goods is by keeping wages and benefits low.
Yes.
Not just for people working in the retail industry, but across the board. Okay, and that played out. You know, even Larry Summers, the famous Larry Summers, admits that incomes, middle class incomes in the United States, are low. Okay, and have been lowered despite soaring productivity. Whereas we all know, the people who profit by all this are the folks at the top. And I think people will be surprised to learn that IKEA's founder, Ingmar Kamprad, is one of the richest men in the world.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, people know about Bill Gates and Microsoft, but they'd be surprised to learn that the largest retailer of furniture in the world, this famous discount retailer who's famously parsimonious, who flies, you know, economy class, and claims to be so frugal, is one of the world's seven richest men.
Yeah.
So someone's profiting by all this discounting. And yes, you're right about IKEA. You know, they actually have a dozen forestry monitors around the world. But nonetheless, the head of their forestry monitoring unit admitted to me that there's no way they can know whether the wood they're using is legal or not, and whether farming that wood is in eastern Russia, where there's tremendous corruption and poaching of wood and very little control over how all that stuff is manufactured. The stuff is dragged over the border to China. There are tremendous labor abuses there. There's a reason why these things are so cheap.
Yeah. Well, I actually want to tie these interesting observations into the labor aristocracy idea that was put out there by Engels and Bakunin. The notion, of course, that Henry Ford put out that is celebrated as an American virtue, that, hey, well, here we have a factory worker who can also afford his own car. I want to kind of unpack what you mentioned in this last answer about relativity and apply this to the worker. Is it really the demand for cheap help that makes the labor aristocracy impossible? Or is it, as Max Elbaum or Robert Seltzer have argued, this political, economic, and cultural advantage that the working class in an advanced country such as ours gets to celebrate? I mean, are higher wages in advanced countries as much of a problem here as the cheaper prices? I mean, certainly a Circuit City executive would say this and use this as an excuse to go ahead and sack their workers. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this and see if we can unpack this rather complicated issue.
Well, look, there's no question, as we see, you know, GM circling the drain, right, that that things perhaps have gone a little too far in the American labor movement, that the unions might have been, you know, for whatever reason, union leadership might have been somewhat unrealistic, or at least have become unrealistic at this time, at this place in time. But you have to remember that fewer than 8% of private employees are now unionized, whereas about a third were in the 1960s and 70s. So the whole union thing is you know, and many of the people who are unionized now are people in the hotel industry and places like that, where wages would be even worse. I mean, they're pretty low as they are. So these protections are minimal now for many, many workers. I mean, most of us don't work for unions unless we have government jobs. I think the most widely unionized jobs right now are teachers. So government workers are much more likely to be unionized than people in the private sector. So the question that we've kind of outpriced, you know, that our workers are too expensive, I do call that into question, okay? I really do call that into question. I use the example of Caterpillar, which, as we all know, is a, you know, iconic American company, you know, based in middle America. You know, if you've ever been out there, and I have, you know, everybody wears a baseball cap with, you know, Caterpillar on it. It's a very proud company. It used to be sort of a cradle-to-grave company where people went to work there and made a career and built a middle-class life for their families, was able to send their kids to college, was able to pay the whole nine yards. And, you know, because of what they said were labor costs, they started outsourcing a lot of their activities at Caterpillar and downsized, and then were able to strong-arm their workers into accepting, the new workers into accepting wage cuts that were just dramatic, about 50% of what their, you know, the fathers of these young men who started to work at Caterpillar were making. You know, very, you know, the decline in wages was dramatic, and benefits, just very, very dramatic. And as one Caterpillar worker said, look, you know, I can't even afford to build a house, okay? I can't afford a house anymore. So, you know, who's going to be using the Caterpillar earth-moving equipment if people can't afford to build or own homes in this area, which is a really good point. If we're paying people so little that they can't afford a decent middle-class life, then we're sort of condemning ourselves to this downward cycle. So when I compare a situation to the Chinese, I'm saying, look, we're kind of biting our own ass here, okay? Mm. We're kind of saying, well, yeah, we want to keep prices really, really low, okay, which means we can only pay ourselves so much because we have to, you know, keep those prices really, really low. And then we find ourselves unable to buy anything but this really cheap stuff. So we don't have discretion. We're not able to buy the so-called good stuff, again, which is much of which, for no reason that I can see, has become a, quote, luxury, you know, quality stuff. And it's this downward cycle that I'm talking about Americans going into debt just to be able to keep their heads above water because their wages and benefits packages are not, you know, they are basically, you know, terrible. They have no job security, which, by the way, this lack of job security is a relatively new thing.
Yeah.
It's laying, IBM never laid anyone off until 1991.
Yeah.
Okay, it's kind of hard to believe that we now have this culture where people are disposable. One way or another on that point, that's something for another book, and several have been written about it. But I think it's something we definitely have to consider, this total lack of job security, the interchangeability of people at work, the notion that one person is as good as another. All this stuff has led to this, not only, you know, economic decline in my mind, but also sort of a massive depression. I mean, we are the most depressed culture on the face of the earth. And I think the notion that quality doesn't count, craftsmanship doesn't count, that an IKEA, you know, dresser made of particle board in the developing world is just as good as a good piece of oak furniture that maybe you buy secondhand,
yeah,
or maybe you get from your grandfather, you know, that had the history, that has meaning to you, that we need to have things that we can throw away, you know, so we can move constantly, that this is something that we, no matter what, you know, the pollution costs or the other auxiliary costs, I'm trying to get people to rethink those things. And I honestly believe, early response to the book from young people has been very, very positive. I mean, they're kind of sick of this.
Yeah.
Kind of sick of this. You know, they're looking for something else.
Well, they may be sick of this, but it goes back just to go back to the question here of labor aristocracy. If we are essentially pining for the virtue of labor aristocracy and the social contract between the worker and the company has been lost, well, of course, people are going to go ahead and flock to discount culture as a way of making up for the deficiencies to fulfill this labor aristocracy. So, I'm wondering if we can entirely blame the worker or the company. I mean, it's a very, very intricate issue, as you say, possibly another book. But to tie it into your book, I'm curious as to how discount culture relates to trying to carry on the virtues, so to speak, of the labor aristocracy.
Well, first of all, I want to please forgive me for kind of modifying this whole notion of labor aristocracy.
Yeah,
there's certainly some folks that benefited greatly by the unionization, as we know, the United Auto Workers, you know, incredibly powerful union, was able to get some incredible concessions in the 70s, you know, for example, a long time ago, for its workers. You know, people had tremendous protections and were able to lead a very solid middle-class life as, working-class folks, blue-collar folks. Of course, a lot of these folks were highly skilled, but we, you know, putting that aside, they had... you know, some of them were, you know, may qualify as aristocracy. Although I can tell you, what we define as aristocracy is oftentimes exaggerated. But most labor in the United States did not reach that height. Okay, we can't say that the hotel workers of America were part of the labor aristocracy. or the wait staff of America was part, or the daycare workers of America were part, and they also were unionized, by the way, were part of this labor aristocracy. You know, the average retail worker in the United States makes $8.75 an hour, okay? So this is no aristocracy, far from it, and actually never really was an aristocracy. When you talk about Ford and the $5 a day man, you know, that was, as I outline in the book, you know, that's, so there's something of a myth there, okay? Ford pulled back from that fairly quickly, and he also used that $5 a day as a way to control his workers. He had those workers to get that $5 a day. They had to abide by a social code, and they were monitored.
Yeah.
People were followed around to make sure that they were moral men, and they were men. So it wasn't everyone at Ford that got the $5 a day. A lot of that whole notion of labor aristocracy is greatly exaggerated. Yeah. So I'm certainly not calling for a resurrection of a labor aristocracy, if there ever was one. I would call that into question. What I'm calling for is reasonableness. If we're going to have a middle class that can buy the things that we make, if we're going to be able to sustain ourselves, we're going to have to rethink the very, very low prices of consumer goods, okay? And we're going to have to think about producing things at a price that people can afford, a reasonable price, but a price that is also sustainable in terms of our economy. And one of the examples I use, I don't know, you may have kids, you may not have kids, but no matter whether you have kids or not, you probably remember things like pencils. Remember pencils?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, number two pencils you have to take. Well, I have kids, so I can tell you, if you go to Target and you buy, or a discount store, and you buy these pencils, you will be just astonished to find that many of these pencils you cannot sharpen. They yeah. fall apart in the sharpener. They have erasers that don't work. I mean, I don't even know how it's possible to create a rubber eraser that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay? So many of these products, these, yes, they're very, very cheap, but they don't work. We have huge waste in the United States, huge waste, stuff that we just throw out. We buy stuff, and part of the, you know, and assume we're going to have to throw it out. We assume a certain percentage of waste. Many of us go to these discount places, buy all sorts of stuff, as I say, use a shopping cart, load it up with stuff, come home and find out. It's almost a triage. Well, it doesn't work, throw it out. Or if we're lucky, you know, a color we don't like, or something that doesn't quite fit, maybe we'll send it to the mission or another charitable organization. We buy so much stuff that we have come not to expect very much. Our relationship with objects has changed dramatically. We don't expect that much. And as one person said to me, a house builder said, we don't think we deserve quality anymore. We don't think we deserve it. That's only for rich people.
Yeah.
Okay, and that I challenge, except for in our automobiles, where we do, and we bargain much less around automobiles than we don't put price necessarily first when we look for an automobile. You know, that's something that, you know, is something that we put quality, you know, very high on our list with automobiles. But most consumer goods, we put price first, and we assume that there are going to be problems with the object.
Yeah.
Okay. Oftentimes we do. We don't assume that unless we pay a luxury price, we don't assume quality. And so it's as I said, we sort of buy ourselves in the ass. We are sort of assuming that, you know, well, like it, you know, look, it's a good T-shirt for $9. It's not a good T-shirt. It's a good T-shirt for $9. Okay, which means we don't expect much of it. If it shrinks, you know. If it fades, that's what we expected. Instead of thinking, shit, I'm going to buy myself a T-shirt that actually works.
Yeah.
That actually, when I drop grape juice on it, you know, I can actually throw it in the wash and wear it again. And I mentioned clothing because that's something, I have two daughters, and a lot of the clothing that you buy at these discounts, purveyors, is really unwashable.
Well,
it stains really easily, and you can't wash it, and you basically have to throw it away.
Yeah. But let's hypothetically say that the Obama administration were to put an end to this discount culture, to demand minimum standards of the goods that we use, to start to crack down on globalization. Well, the free market economist will then turn around and say, well, hey, look at what Andrew Jackson did when he investigated corruption within the Second Bank of the United States. I mean, Jackson discovered that the money was being used to corrupt elections. He deposited all this tax revenue into other state banks. And, of course, the Second Bank started to lose money. And then we had the financial panic of 1837. So, I guess...
I'm not arguing. I do not argue against the position in the book.
Okay.
I do not take on that argument. I qualify the notions, the theories that promote a certain kind of globalization. I talk about David Ricardo and his theories, okay?
Yes.
Which is, okay, so we go way, way back historically, and we look at what it really means. When I talk about globalization, when we talk about being a global or being a flat world, as my friend Tom Friedman would put it, we have to think about, okay, if the world is truly flat, we have the benefits and the responsibilities of globalism. And that's what I argue in the book. I argue, look, the kinds of do unto others as you would have others do unto you, otherwise you're going to get bit. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's what's happened to the American middle class. We're being bit big time, big time, because there's this notion that we can, you know, take this so-called globalism, and globalism is a one-way street. That is, that we can go and take goods and services from around the globe and, you know, through labor arbitrage, move. If China's not cheap enough, as I point out in the book, we'll move to Vietnam. If Vietnam's not cheap enough, where are we going to go? Africa, okay? We'll go wherever there's not rule of law, that will allow us to manufacture things with no pollution controls, with no human rights controls. Great, let's just do that so we can get the cheapest things possible, cheap, cheap, cheap for us.
Yeah.
But as I point out, and there's an argument that's probably too complicated to, you know, tell you on the phone, but it's in the book.
Yeah.
This has come back to haunt us.
Yeah.
So globalism is a great thing. Absolutely. I believe in free trade. I believe in all that stuff. It's great. And we're not going to go back. I mean, we've got the technology. We can't put that genie back in the bottle. I'm not a romanticist. You know, I'm not a Luddite. I love my cell phone. You know, I do Twitter. I have a blog. I'm into all that stuff. But we have to think, with that privilege comes a responsibility, or it's going to come back. And it has come back. It has come back. That's why, frankly, this book is being called so timely. Because it has come back. You know, if I'd written this book maybe 2 years ago, or it'd come out 2 years ago, I think I'd be under a lot more stress to try to substantiate my points. But now I'm finding, you know, people are going, right, right. Yeah. That's what's happened. So it's not, you know, globalism, fine. But the idea that we can just, for example, outsource all our work to China and become the creative entrepreneurial society, where all the good positions in this society only involve creativity and entrepreneurship, is so naive as to be bizarre, because people in China and India are very creative and entrepreneurial. We do not have a corner on that market. We need good jobs with good wages and benefits here in the United States in all different sectors, whether it's the service sector, which is the largest sector, or the creative worker sector, which is a much smaller sector, okay? We need those protections in the United States. We cannot outsource, we cannot go on the idea, as some have put forward, that we're going to outsource all our grunt work to the developing world, and we're going to be left with the wonderful opportunities, creative opportunities, entrepreneurial opportunities, and that this so-called workers' jobs should be outsourced to the lowest bidder.
Sure.
This is not working for us. Not working for us, and it's very, very short-sighted and naive.
Well, to try to resolve what has become a rather complicated conversation, I want to put one last question to you, and that is, you brought up Ricardo earlier and his theory of comparative advantage, which you also talk about a little bit in the book. Douglas Rushkoff, in his last book, Life, Inc., argues that comparative advantage is not really applied to debtor nations. And I'm curious if, based off of the fact that you bring it up and based off of the fact that you've just said, hey, free trade can in fact work, whether you have a similar stance. Is comparative advantage one of those theories that is more likely to apply to individuals and small businesses as opposed to large conglomerates or corporations? I'm just curious.
Well, you know, David Ricardo was the political economist in the 1800s,
yeah.
And he's most famous for his theory of competitive advantage, and that is that by, as we all know, I mean, it's a very old and venerable theory, that, and actually quite smart, actually, you know, rather brilliant. You know, the question of, look, if we can make goods in one country more efficiently than we can in another, why do we not just make all goods in the country that's more efficient? And he made an argument, a very sophisticated argument, about why we need to trade, even if, say, England is more efficient in making several products than is Portugal, it's still better for all, more advantageous, more profitable for all, if both countries manufacture and trade. And I outline the logic in the book. It's actually very, very clever. But that was before computers. That was before globalism. That was before, Ricardo could never even imagine just-in-time delivery of products, okay? Or the retailing, the so-called lean retailing methods that we have today, okay? This whole theory, needs to be modified in our modern thinking. And that is, you're absolutely right about debtor countries are losing their competitive advantage. They don't have the leverage, especially in countries like China, where people do not have the rights that they have in the United States, the right to protest. So what we've done, of course, is outsource labor mistreatment and outsource environmental degradation to the developing world to do our dirty work, basically, where we can't see it, as you said before. Exactly, we cannot see it. But again, in a global world, this is going to come back to us, okay, because it works both ways. It's a two-way system now. They also have computers. They also have the technology. They know what's going on. This is no surprise. And part of the effect of this is some of the things that are being sent back to us are less than optimal. You know, we've read about the children's toys with leaded paint. We've read about the tainted food, the exploding tires that are coming back to us from China, okay? Because the controls in those countries are not what the controls are in our country. And so these products that were, these manufactured products that we're outsourcing and saying, hey, this is great, we can get these things really, really cheaply, well, again, they're coming back to haunt us. This is what has happened. So, yes, to some degree, I definitely concur that Ricardo's theories do not necessarily apply to the so-called debtor nations or to nations that are willing to have, without controls that can benefit their own workers, their own environment. Those countries are not in a position to bargain the way countries were able to, the Portugal and England, for example, in the Ricardo example. So, yeah, I do agree with that.
Well, on that note, Ellen, this has been certainly a scenario in which talk has not been cheap, but rather valuable. But thanks very much for taking the time out to talk. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You too, Adam. Okay.